really good to be with you. I always say, I got to say this again. I wore this out at the forum, I know, but I think it's never too, you can never say this too often. I always look at Bartlesville as kind of that city on the shining hill, you know, that great example of what it's like to be just close enough to a big city to go if you want to, but you're isolated enough that you can just know everybody. And I always jokingly say in small town America, like I grew up over in the Ozark Mountains, you know everybody whether you want to or not. And so it, you know, it can be challenging at times. Yes, you're close, but you know, it's really an honor to be with you. I do really value everybody's opinion of Washington County. It's, again, there's just such a long legacy of what Bartlesville means to not only the first district, but for the state. And I would say this to the country and to the world with, you know, the founding of Phillip 66 and all that meant and, you know, all the things that have done there. But it's great to be with you. And it's been a crazy week. Crazy couple of weeks, but I try to focus on the policy side of this and not so much on the politics, because what you all do, whether it's in the financial community or whether it's in the chamber community, is helping businesses make sure that they stay open and service them, because we all know in an economy like ours in the United States, it's built on the foundation of people working and paying taxes and living independent lives with liberty and freedom. It's so important to have that and not be dependent on the federal government. And this last year has been very, very trying. I've done six of these. I think this is the seventh one I've done in 3 days now with various chambers around the district. And one of the things I think it's important to do is go back and talk about, as painful as it is, kind of what the last 10 months has looked like. And I know, you know, you're a very conservative county, a very conservative city, in a sense that you really just like to be left alone. But when we have situations happen like this, where we have a pandemic and to no fault of your own, that you're having these major shutdowns and the inability to stay open and have demand for your product, that you're really looking for some help. And the place that comes from in a mass way is from the federal government or from the state or the cities and or the counties. But it all pretty much trickles down from the federal government. And, you know, it was really an honor to work together in a very bipartisan way in mid-March to have the PPP program that came out. I mean, it's incredible. In the midst of all of the impeachment process that was going on this time last year right now, and here we are a year later doing the same thing again, but all the impeachment process going on. And then immediately we all came together. I think there were only three people that voted against helping businesses across America. So we know that on a flip of a switch, we can all work together. And businesses, you have to figure out how to work together to move forward. So it's really important to do that. And we did it. We put out the PPP money in the first tranche. It was roughly $350 billion in just round numbers. And the guidance was there that we thought we could save millions of jobs. And in fact, all estimates were that it was roughly 51 million jobs in America were saved from being let go and laid off. And the reason they would have been let go or laid off is because businesses would have closed or their demand would have been so low that they would have been, you know, they would have been a place that didn't need anybody. So it's important to note that the program worked as advertised. Another $250 billion was put into that as we sort of got toward the end. And in August 8th, when the period to be able to apply passed, there was still $138 billion stranded in that account. It had been authorized and appropriated into that account to help businesses across America. And our timeline expired. And so many of us, people like myself that understand the value of small businesses in the United States Congress, worked feverishly to get that as a standalone bill and never could make it happen. It was the speaker, the majority controls the House agenda. The Speaker Pelosi knew that it would pass just in an incredible way. So she didn't want to put that in on a standalone because it would take it on, taking away some of her leverage to ultimately pass the bill that we passed in late December. And so late December, we passed the COVID relief bill, $908 billion that had money to help schools, $82 billion in there to help expedite vaccinations across America. Should you want to do a vaccination, no mandatory position on that. Also to help, you know, small businesses to get money back out there. In addition to the $138 billion that was stranded, it was funded back up to over $300 billion in that. And it also had the opportunity to get a second round if you were in a particular business, mainly hospitality and restaurant business, or those who supplied to those particular industries, the chance to come back and get a second round of PPP in a much narrower, targeted environment. And for those that maybe weren't impacted early on, our state is kind of one of those examples that was kind of late getting impacted. You have the ability to go and get a first round of PPP under the same rules that were used last year. So as we've kind of moved forward to this, you know, I'm excited to know that we're still helping our small businesses in America. And, you know, some in the big business world say, well, what about us? And so there was a Main Street lending program that money got clawed back. And a lot of those as our big businesses started to grow. Mainly big business in our particular state, our aerospace industry and our oil and gas industry. And our oil and gas industry now, you know, seeing the price per barrel recover. We obviously have ConocoPhillips, Phillips 66 up in Bartlesville. And so we're seeing that kind of come back because of the demand for fuel is coming back because our economies are starting to open up in different places. And we saw today that Oklahoma's unemployment is continuing. The unemployment is continuing to decline as we continue to get people back to work. And that's exciting for all of us in here, whether you're the business owner or whether you're the banks who are doing the financial lending and the financial services, or you're the chambers that are representing these individual businesses. So it's exciting for that. But, and I'll also tell you that, you know, we had this direct stimulus and, I've gotten some criticism because I didn't support the $2,000 per person. In the COVID relief bill, there was $600 per person. I did support that. I would like for it been more targeted. And as we moved to, you know, beyond the COVID relief bill, there was a push to do a standalone $2,000 additional money. And I voted no on that. I mean, obviously my record is what it is, but I thought we needed to pay for that. And everybody says, well, you don't care about people. I do care. I think we have an opportunity, as I said in my onset here, about helping those who need the most help, giving that hand up, and businesses are no different than that. But as far as sending out $2,000 to everybody in America, that would have cost the American people, more importantly, your children and grandchildren, another $457 billion for that one check to go out to all of America. And there are areas of the country that are still in a really bad spot. As we start seeing that, we could focus our attention on those. And that would be critically important because we want people to go out and spend money in the communities because the communities need it for sales tax and the counties need it for tax as well, and the state ultimately. But just as an example of, you know, community banks, and I don't know if Trevor is in the same position, but he's probably seen some of this. But in my conversation across our district and across the state and through some of the representatives for across the country, many areas where you've had less of an impact of COVID-19, the banks have seen tremendous increases in deposits, meaning that the people put that money away for a rainy day as opposed to spending it in the economy, which was reason for sending that money out was to make sure that people had groceries, could pay their rents, their car payments, buy clothes, make sure their kids could go to school, have the necessary things so it would keep the communities and the cities going. But a lot of people didn't need the money, so they just saved it. And so we should have gotten a good indication of how to better target the stimulus money. I know you probably have seen yesterday or today that President Biden, soon to be President Biden, is wanting to do a $1.9 trillion stimulus program to send these checks out along with some other things. And so instead of $457 billion, we're going to spend $1.9 trillion. And that doesn't include another round of PPP money that I anticipate that will be coming out. This money here is set aside until March 31st. I anticipate that at March 31st, if we're still having issues, we're going to see another targeted round. Hopefully it's targeted. That maybe squeezes a little tighter the parameters by which you get a second or a third loan. But here's the thing. At the end of all of this, we've got to figure out how to start getting our fiscal house in order. I've been talking about this since when I was running, when I was in Congress, since I've been in Congress, rather. I've been on the budget committee. The budget committee is very political. We haven't created a budget since 1996. So both Democrats and Republicans are responsible for the the crazy spending and the out of whack borrowing that we've done. And we've got to get after this. And I've been known as a person, as a business person, as a person who says you need to create a budget, whether you're doing your household, your business, or your city, your county, or state. All of those entities have to create a budget, except for the federal government does not. And that's where we're getting really out of whack. And every person in America right now, every family in America owes $233,000. That if you paid the national debt off right now, every family in America would have to pay $233,000. And somebody ultimately is going to have to pay that off, because it's stifling growth. It's stifling the ability to get returns on your savings. All of these things really matter. And so I was asked to serve as the budget committee chairman for the Republican Study Committee, which is the policy team for the Republican Party. And we will have a budget produced in April that shows us balancing within 10 years. That's something that's not even been produced in the last 4 years, showing a balanced budget in 10 years. Balanced budget means we stop having deficits. We have to stop having annual deficits, meaning spending more than we make, before we can actually start paying down our debt. So that will be out in April. And then finally, before we get to the Q&A, you know, we talk about spending, that's what you hear about. But people ask me, say, you know, what are you seeing since you've been there? And so we've spent our term in office, looking at what is it that we should do to get our country back on a pathway that we're not always having these conversations about crisis, funding the government year to year. How do we get better? Just like you would do in business. You sit down and say, I'm tired of this. You know, it's the old saying, stupidity is the idea. You keep doing the same thing over and over and over and expecting different results. So we came up with eight different areas that if we attack these, that we would start moving government to be more responsible. And I think if it's more responsible, the American people have more confidence and more trust in it doing the right thing. The first one is term limits. Been a big hawk on term limits, saying that we need to get our congressmen and women, both House and Senate, in a term limits environment, constitutional term limits, so that individuals are not leaving office and turning over, say, in Oklahoma, but we keep New Yorkers and Californians in there for 30, 40, 50 years. And so a constitutional term limit, just so you know, it's the most popular idea in America among the average person, people like us. Almost 90% of Americans want term limits on the members of Congress. The president has them. Our state house has them. Many states have them, but not the federal government. The next two, number two and three, are about the budget. If we don't produce a budget, then we can't ever get our spending under control. So no budget, no pay, or no budget, no recess, meaning you can't go home. You can't use federal money to go home, not you, not your staff, to go home until you get a budget done. And that's something we need to do at the beginning of the year, not fuss and fight at the end of the year and do crazy spending bills. The next two, four and five, are related to what members of Congress aspire to do once they've been here for a term or two. Many people in Congress have been lifelong politicians. You know, they started out at city councils or school boards and worked their way through to state house and then got to Congress. And they said, okay, and they're much younger than I. And they said, okay, what's my next gig? Well, my next gig will be a lobbyist. And they can do that in 1 to 2 years based on the type of industry and what they do immediately following getting out of Congress. So I believe if we move that to 10 years, we will change the attitude of how we work and what we do while we're in Congress among all members of Congress, not just some of those like myself who didn't go there for a career or the pay, but really to get something done. It's very frustrating when you're trying to get something done and people are gauging about, if I do that, am I going to get my lobbying gig in, you know, a year to 2 years after I leave here? The next three are pretty common sense. Read the bills. I mean, you wouldn't sign a contract from the banks or wherever unless you read it. We're getting these massive bills that are last minute. And so we need to work through the process of the committee so we have the time to read the bills before we sign them. Number seven is eliminating this negotiation through the earmarks program. The Democrats are wanting to bring that back this cycle. And it's very problematic. It was eliminated back about 10 years ago. And so this is an opportunity for us to, you know, hammer down on that. And then finally, I also said that when I ran for Congress, I didn't go there for the pension. And then until I got there and found out that it is impossible for a member of Congress to actually opt out of the federal pension program. And so we're going to make that, that should be an easy one. I can't believe that no member of Congress has ever asked for that to happen. So we're going to work to make that happen as well. So those eight things, I think if we attack those, that we would actually be on a pathway to have a more responsible Congress, both House and Senate, by the way. So Sherry, with that, and Trevor, I've said a lot. And so we'll just go with the questions and we'll see what kind of questions we have.
Okay, remember, if you all have questions, type them in the Q&A box there. We do have a couple that came in. So how do you think we can better target future stimulus payments to ensure the funds that are spent and increase economic activity?
Yeah, so we have lots of, let me just give you one example. I was on, I think I was on a call, I don't know what it was, one of the chamber calls, yes, maybe in Tulsa Chamber, and somebody asked about the Oklahoma Employment Security Commission computer system. So every state is responsible for running its unemployment funds. And every state has a standalone computer system that has a connection to the federal government. So back in March, when we were looking at doing this targeted federal unemployment assistance program, that was the $600 extra per week that many as business people got real excited, was fearful that it wouldn't allow people to come back to work because they were making so much money. Well, that $600 was $600 in Oklahoma per week, and same thing in New York and California, where the cost of living is 2 to 3 times higher than Oklahoma. And so in that case, it was originally proposed that, you know, you do 900 in New York and 300 in Oklahoma, you know, kind of in between there, just because you're trying to equilibrate to have the same percentage of help for disposable income, until they found out you couldn't do it that way because there was no, the technology wouldn't allow it. So that's why everybody just got 600. So not targeted at all. And I say all that to say this, we have a technological problem in many cases to do like the federal unemployment. That's why it's $300 now, because again, it's blanket across the board. But when you're talking about giving direct stimulus, we could have lowered the overall cost or done it by, we have wages that are, you know, poverty level wages. We have all this stuff by state, by communities within states that we could have targeted these dollars to. But the $75,000 cap before you start seeing that go away up to $99,000 per year is for everybody in America. So somebody making $75,000 in Oklahoma is doing much better with disposable income and the ability to buy than somebody doing $75,000 in New York City. So again, very targeted. We could do a better job based on the data we have. We have all of that data, but it's just sort of politically expedient just to say we're going to send it out to everybody. And it's pretty unfortunate because all of us will equally have to pay back the debt in our future generations.
Okay, this kind of tags on a little bit with that. What concerns do you have with the increase in debt as we approach $30 trillion? Is the government talking about the impact of this when debating the stimulus program? I mean, has it ever come up?
Let me answer the last part of that first. The answer is absolutely no. Nobody's talking about it except a few of us. And I can assure you that we don't have a lot of media coverage on people talking about the rise in debt. And that's why it was so important for me to be the budget committee chairman. I asked for that. I've been running to get that. I think that's a really important thing. And for a person that's only been there for 2 years to get that position, it's unheard of. It's usually somebody that's been there 10 years. But it's just a big deal with me. I campaigned on it. I see it in business. Yes, we have the ability to print money, but none of us anticipated this. And some people could say that maybe, don't appreciate where we're at and say we need the money. I will tell you that prior to COVID, we weren't doing a budget. So COVID has nothing to do with our spending, insatiable appetite to spend and borrow money. Yes, we had to do a supplemental budget of about $4 trillion to be able to fund all the COVID issues, $4 to $5 trillion. We'll see the ultimate number when it's done. We're not done yet. But we had a problem with spending long before COVID ever got here. As I said, it's not just Democrats. It's Republicans and Democrats have this. Nobody wants to make the hard decisions because the media will take you and say you're throwing grandma off the cliff or you're not doing the right thing for the American people. But the right thing for the American people, and every individual knows this individually, is that we can't keep doing what we're doing. But the collective mentality is I, as an example, the 2000, I want my 2000, don't give it to that person. But $2,000 per person is $457 billion in new borrowing. And we're getting ready to see that go out here in about 2 weeks, along with another $1.4 trillion.
Amazing. Okay, here's one kind of switching gears a little bit. What is your opinion on opening schools back up nationally, and what motivation can you give schools to do so?
I'm not a big favor of somebody in Washington, D.C. telling us in Bartlesville or Dewey or Nowata to open your schools. I think, as I've said in many school board meetings, sort of impromptu when I've asked this question, whether it was in Bixby or wherever it may have been, I think local school boards, the local parents, the local administration knows better about what's going on in that community than somebody even in Oklahoma City or somebody in Washington, D.C., certainly, is that schools are a local decision and you shouldn't bow to any pressure externally. You should do exactly what you think is right for your communities, because that's that you, there's not administration in Bartlesville that doesn't know parents and know the kids. And you know what's right. You also know the implications of not educating kids. You know that it is almost an impossibility to keep a third grader in front of a computer for 6 or 7 hours a day. It's hard enough for us as adults to do it and try to keep a concentration level high enough to learn something, much less a third grader or, you know, seventh grader. We you know what I'm saying. And I just think that we have to make those decisions locally. I am a person, I was in the franchising business for 35 years. I look at every person's ability to try things as laboratories of experiments. And I hope, and I've said this to many people, I've said it to Joy Hoffmeister and others, and Betsy DeVos, I said, you should take school districts and use those as best bets or examples of how to open your school. And are you doing those? Some schools are better and have more of ability to do protective equipment, whether it's shields or have nurses on site, than other schools, just because ventilation systems in some schools and some buildings in some school districts are better than others. So you know what you can do based on the what you have. And just to say, you know, an edict comes down from Oklahoma City that you say, open up all schools. I'm not that kind of guy. I think the local school districts, because you're going to answer at a local school board meeting, at a PTA meeting, or our school board elections of whether you did the right thing or not.
Okay. How about, can you explain the reasoning of limiting the IRS sending out the second stimulus money of a deadline of today, January 15th?
I can't. I've got staff on here. I'll have to find out. Some of it may be just from a staffing standpoint. I've got to tell you, Washington, D.C. is in a it's in a total lockdown right now with what's going on. But also, we've had a lot of problems getting a lot of those folks have been distance working. So them getting access just from a sheer volume of the first round of stimulus. I'm assuming we're talking about the $600 stimulus check is going out January 15th. That's what I'm assuming. We'll find out, though. We'll get it back to you, Sherry, and you can disseminate that among the folks who are on the call.
How about this one? What silver linings do you see for conservatives over the next 2 years with progressives running all three levels of Congress? Where can we look for hope? Do you think any of them will be a little bit more moderate and maybe work together? Or is it just going to be party line down?
No, I don't think, obviously I've only been in politics for 2 years, so I've been a sort of a sideliner like everybody on this call for my entire life. But what I do see happening, this is a different in control than previous times, like in 2010 when, or 2008, 2010, when President Obama came in for those first 2 years, we had super majorities in the Senate. He actually had filibuster proof majority in the Senate, which meant he had more than 60 votes. And in the House, he had a super majority in the House where you can do anything and still lose some Democrats and get things passed. That's not this case now. Nancy Pelosi only has, she can only lose six Democrats, six moderate Democrats before she can't pass a bill. Same thing in the Senate. The Senate is dead even. So anything that's controversial, Kamala Harris has got to come over, Vice President Harris has got to come over and cast that deciding vote. These are going to be very contentious votes. There'll be moderate Democrats like Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia will become very prevalent. He will be the one that will actually, he's already said, I might get rid of the filibuster. And so that's huge on the Senate side. It gives the minority a voice. And then, you know, as you talk to folks, I was talking with a friend of mine that's a Democrat from Minnesota. I said, Dean, we've got to find some things we can work on. We can't have another 2 years, because he was a freshman. He came in the same time I did. He's a business owner in Minnesota, restaurant guy. And I said, we've got to find things we can work on. He totally agreed. So I think the mood is there. Everybody's worn out on the fighting and the arguing, as I said yesterday and previous calls as well. I think we'll all disagree on where it comes to our fossil fuel industry and the Green New Deal. Most of us in the Republican Party are all the above. We have wind and solar and we have hydro, but our fossil fuels are so, so critically important to Oklahoma and for the school districts of Oklahoma because of the tax revenues and for the level of labor force that in Oklahoma has and for the wages paid is so important. So we're going to have to find ways that we can disagree on that, as we've been doing, and still move forward. But on areas of protecting small businesses, you know, sensible tax policy, we've got to find the right way to move forward.
Okay. How about this? We have a lot of flights to and from the Tulsa airport. Is there anything in the most recent stimulus to help the airline industry to hopefully maintain the level of service provided to our region?
Yeah, so that was huge for me. That was one of the big reasons I supported the COVID relief bills, because as most of you know, American Airlines has the largest maintenance and repair operations of any airline in the world, is based here in Tulsa with over 5,500 people working, many high paying jobs. And then all the people that supply the small businesses, the machine shops, the personnel services, all these different things are sitting there. And inside the CARES Act, there was $15 billion set aside for airlines to use for their payroll services. And so when that passed, you immediately saw Americans start talking about bringing people back. As a person who flies in and out, you know, twice a week from Tulsa, I know a lot of the gate agents. And so just yesterday, I was talking to the gate agent, asking her if things were getting better. And she said, absolutely, people are coming back. You saw where Southwest Airlines brought back a lot of their people that had been furloughed. The big thing for the airlines is getting the economy open, getting travel back open, because we cannot print enough money to keep them all going for, you know, an indeterminate amount of time. We have to get demand back up, just like we have to do for our oil and gas industry.
Okay. What about this one? Will this next stimulus bill have AGI caps? You may have mentioned it, but I missed it.
I'm sure it will. It'll be probably the same caps of $75,000 for the maximum amount. So, and then it'll stair step down to $99,000. My big deal is trying to keep members of Congress from getting this, because if you're a household, married that, and your wife doesn't work, and you're the only one working, you're making $174,000. That's under the $198,000 cap. So you won't get the full amount. I mean, a member of Congress, is that we should exclude congressmen and women, because I know a lot of members of Congress that got checks the first time and they're going to get them this time as well. We need to stop that nonsense. Members of Congress don't need a stimulus check. They've got a job. They're working every single day. Nothing's changed for them other than being a little crazy up there. You know, we need to make sure, again, we target this money so that we're going to the right people that have the real need.
Okay, here's another one. Is there any chance we can see a limited liability provision for companies or schools that have opened safely and in accordance with CDC and other regulations in this new relief bill?
I would tell you no. And I'm a person that I'm not going to give anybody a false hope. Mitch McConnell in the Republican Senate said for all year that he would not let anything else come to the floor that didn't have lawsuit protections for not just businesses, but for hospitals and libraries and, you know, all kinds of people because of the class action lawsuits. I think we're over 5,000 class action lawsuits across America now because of COVID. And to get the $908 billion COVID relief bill in December, Majority Leader McConnell traded off not giving $160 billion of additional monies to cities and states. And so that's basically what the cost of this was to the trial lawyers was, we're not going to spend, because the Democrat Party wanted the $160 billion of additional money to states and cities. The Republican leaders wanted lawsuit protections, or, you know, just like this, this question. And both said, we'll set that aside and deal with it next time. There's no appetite for my colleagues across the aisle to have lawsuit protections because there's too much lobbying money comes over. So I don't see it. I don't know where I don't know why they would, I guess is the point from a political standpoint.
Okay. How about, great question. How do we keep overseas money and slush money from going into the next bill? Should be simple, but.
Yeah, most of that money, I know people don't like to hear this, but most of that money was requested by the State Department. And so typically when the State Department requests that money, it's authorized and appropriated to those bills when it goes into these omnibus bills or these appropriating bills. So just give everybody a quick history how this starts. The Office of Management Budget advises all the federal governments on their budgets. They roll these all together, send them to the president. The president approves them. Then they go back to OMB, which is, again, the Office of Management and Budget. That's the folks on the executive branch that monitors the request. That's the president's budget. The president's budget goes to the House. It's debated. The House does theirs and the Senate does theirs. That's the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office. They do an analysis. That all comes together. And the foreign spending, the foreign operations are looked at. And usually, that's not a committee I sit on, so I don't know what the debates are. Typically, as I've asked about some of these that were in there, some of these where it says, let's use the one that's really controversial, gender studies, was really about getting women more rights in Pakistan. I don't remember the money, but that's an example of that. Another one was, I remember it was something to do in some obscure country in the Indian Ocean or somewhere up there. And that was to help that government stand up a port so that we could bring our shallow draft Navy ships in to help stop drug interdiction and give us a base between India and China for our Navy ships to come into. So we weren't dependent on India or Pakistan or the Chinese government for that. So some of these are like that. They're in lieu of defense spending. They go through the foreign ops, the State Department, so that they don't have this controversial stigma put on because they're not defense. And it's a way, quite frankly, in some of those cases to get it out of the defense budget and put it in the state budget. So I don't have a direct answer for this. There's always been federal spending all the way back to our foreign spending all the way back to Thomas Jefferson. And there will always be foreign spending going forward just because of our national interest.
Okay. Anyone else have questions? Type them in. And do you have any parting words, anything of encouragement for us?
Well, I think, we will certainly get, a different view of government starting a week from Monday as the Biden administration comes in with the House. And the House has obviously been under Democrat rule, but now the Senate will be under Democrat rule. So there will be a very aggressive agenda to get things pushed through in a very aggressive manner. And a lot of that will be tax increases. President Biden has already said he wanted to increase taxes roughly $4 trillion. I mean, that's what it's going to take. I don't know where you're going to actually get those unless you go deep into corporations and go after them and taking back from 35 to 21, taking us back, which will assure us that a lot of corporations will not move their jobs back from China because as some of you are big business people on this call, one of the reasons you don't just immediately pick up and move back to the United States because you know the next Congress can undo the very tax codes that they're railing on you about to bring back the jobs. So that's one. We also know that the Green New Deal, to some form, whether it's $5 trillion or $10 trillion that President Biden's talked about, or whether it's $93 trillion that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her folks are talking about, and some of the more California-driven Democrats that are on the Natural Resource and Energy and Commerce Committees are wanting to get done, or whether it's Medicare for all. What we think we'll see happen a week from Monday is we're going to see an aggressive posture on raising taxes and doing a direct stimulus to the American people and propping up and spending more money on getting toward universal health care, which is the next step or the last step to getting to single payer. And the reason the tax is important is because the only way they're going to get anything done rapidly without having a supermajority in the Senate is through a thing called budget reconciliation, which means whatever they spend, they have to have an offset. They have to have an offset on revenue over the next 10 years so that it basically is zero. And so they'll have to raise taxes in order to get this done. And so there'll be a lot of budget, and it can only be done one time. So this will be done on the 2021 budget, and then the 2022 budget will be done in the summer. And so there'll be another budget reconciliation go through.
Okay. Actually, I've got a couple that came in through the chat box, and I was watching Q&A and not chat. So here is, where'd it go? Hang on. There's a lot of thanking yous here. I'm amazed at the amount of spending that occurred in the most recent election cycle. How do we create more transparency in political donations and campaign finance?
Well, everything is transparent. If you go to FEC.gov, there's really two. Really, the best place to go is a place called OpenSecrets.org. I think it is OpenSecrets.org. And it shows all the different money raised for committees. So these are like 501c4s. These are monies raised for committees from organizations. But this is all open information. We have to file every month an update to our fundraising. I have to file every month an update to our financial status. Our fundraising we have to do every quarter. And so that's all in there. That's on the FEC.gov website. The only thing that's not transparent is what some of these are called independent expenditures are. And this was back when the Citizens United group won. I don't know if that's like 7 or 8, 10 years ago now, where if unions were able to give money, why couldn't individual businesses if they were to establish these kind of organizations? And so that money is huge, but that money can't go directly into a campaign. They have to go out, and they can't even coordinate with a candidate. It's against a lot of people go to prison for that, and there are several in prison now for that. They have to go out and run issue spots. So when you see something, it's doesn't mention a candidate's name, or maybe they do mention a candidate's name, but it says at the bottom, this is paid for by this organization. That has nothing to do with input from that candidate. That's somebody that has an interest, like oil and gas, that may go run a top line because there are members, there's a race going on that one of the people doesn't support oil and gas and the other one does. And they're running that high level to remind people that that one person does not support oil and gas, as an example. And everything else, though, is very transparent, including how much money you take in and how much money you spend and where you spend it and who gave you the money and all that kind of stuff.
And they have to file the ethics reports, and it's all in there. So. Yep. Is there any hope for an infrastructure spending bill in 2021?
In 2021, I'm not sure. I can tell you it's probably the most bipartisan conversation that goes on in Congress all the time. Everybody knows we need, there's been numbers like we need $1 trillion right now to start patching potholes, up to $4 trillion to get ahead of the game. The issue is how you pay for it. And I think there's probably a little more energy now among everybody to say, let's don't spend money over here on stimulus. Why don't we take and create an infrastructure program and put a lot of people to work? And this is going to sound bad, but it's kind of like the old WPA program back after World War II, or after the Depression, rather. Let's, instead of going, just continue pumping money out there to individuals, when we put them, get them back into a job. And, maybe after, $4 or $5 trillion in spending, we could have taken that same amount of money, created a infrastructure program in America and had everybody working as opposed to getting unemployment. So I think there's a real energy behind it. We know we have to, we have no choice. Here's something to remember, a little history. Every great civilization that's ever been known on this planet has failed because it couldn't maintain their infrastructure. And we don't want to be the next. Sure. If you think about that, think about the Roman Empire, think about the Chinese Empire, think about the British Empire. They all fell because they couldn't support their infrastructure around the world.
Okay, I think we've got time for one more, and there's one more over in the chat box. How do we get away from the us and them conversations?
Well, I can tell you, and that's what drives everybody that's in business, including myself, crazy. You know, like I said, there are some things you're never going to agree on. If you're a pro-life candidate or a pro-life person like I am, strong pro-life, you're not going to find a whole lot of love across the aisle. It's just fact. I mean, you can go look this up. I'm not going to tell you anything. You can't go Google and find this out. But the Democrat National Committee told the Democrats, we have no place in Congress in the Democrat Party for anybody that's pro-life. So if you're not pro-life, then that doesn't really matter to you. But those are issues that are brought up time and time again. As an example, Rosa DeLauro, who was being head of appropriations, which is where the money, who allocates the money to all programs out there, including the foreign aid that you mentioned just a minute ago, under Ronald Reagan, the Henry Hyde Amendment is that we would not give our foreign money to entities or to countries around the world that would use some of that money to go promote abortion among women in those countries. It was called the Henry Hyde Amendment. President Trump used that more than any Republican president has ever done it. Rosa DeLauro said she is suspending that rule. So we're spending more money on foreign aid today than we probably have spent, you know, in 40 years. And there will be no limitations of where that money can be spent. So we as Republicans will never agree with the Democrats on that. So there, it will always be us and them. You mentioned infrastructure. That's the complete opposite of that. You talk about defense spending. There are defense hawks in the Democrat Party that want to continue moving forward, modernizing our military. There are others that don't. The same thing in the Republican Party. There are Republicans who don't want to spend money. So you've got us versus them, both in the Republican Party and the Democrat Party. And those of us that think, you know, one of the constitutional duties we have as members of Congress, there's really only four, but one of the most prominent ones and most important ones is we protect this great nation from people who want to harm us. And the only way we have to do that is from our military. And so those are, I mean, it's politics. I always tell people, including myself from time to time, don't watch TV because they're going to find the most polar opposite issues because they sell ads based on how much controversy they can create. And that's unfortunate for the American people because you struggle finding places to get what's going on in Washington, D.C. And it's tough. I mean, it really is. But there's a lot more, not in the last couple of weeks, but there's a lot more get along, if you will, to get things done than some would see. Probably the most bipartisan committee in Congress is the Small Business Committee, which I served on for 2 years. It was a joy to go in there. It's something I knew very, very well. And everybody on that committee, there was about 35 of us, worked to make sure small businesses in America had a pathway forward.
Okay. Well, I know that you do need to jump on another call, but I thank you so very much for your time. I know, like I said earlier, you've got a very busy schedule. Also, I want to thank you and your staff for help setting this up and working with us. And big shout out to my staff for getting it set up and the format. And anyhow, we appreciate all of you guys, and we wish you all the very best and keep fighting strong.
I just want to say one thing. I didn't answer this, but on the SBA information for the PPP loans, Adam's going to post up there. He may have already done it in the chat room, but SBA.gov, he's just posting that now, will give you all of the parameters for the PPP loans that actually, I don't know if Trevor's still in here or not, but I think they're starting to make the loans today to everybody in mass across the nation. The first couple of days this week were for the minority communities, minority lenders. But starting Wednesday was a transition, I think, starting yesterday. So I would encourage you to get in the queue on that. And if you haven't ever gotten one, to get that done. If you're doing your second one, making sure you meet that criteria to get the second one and move forward. This is for keeping people employed. This isn't for the business owners. There's no business owners get any of this money. This is all about payroll and paying rents and utilities. So if you haven't gotten it, take a look at it. Talk to your local lender.
Yes, and I think that you're right. They do open today. So anyhow, we've sent stuff out from the chamber side. Good. In fact, one of the pieces came from your office. It was a great information sheet, easy to understand, easy to read. So I know we've sent things out, but also check this out. So good information. So thanks, anyhow, Mary. With that, we appreciate it. Wish you all the very best. And like I said, Good luck up there.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks.